You can believe every word he said about me. My name is Mike Fitzpatrick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mike.
My sobriety date is April 23rd, 1985, and for that I'm grateful. I want to thank the committee and Harlan for inviting Joy and I to spend this weekend with you. I'm not sure if I'm comfortable being the last speaker, though. Following the speakers, I think they all did a wonderful job, and it's really been nice to be here. And coming from Chandler, Arizona, our weather is a lot like yours. It's very consistent. And Chandler's outside of Phoenix. My home group's in Gilbert, Arizona. It's the We Ain't Dead Yet group. And we meet on Mondays and Wednesdays, and if you ever make it to the Phoenix area, we'd love to have you as our guest. Last night, I had the opportunity to speak with Howard, who was supposed to speak here at the conference, and I just want to let you know, Pat came out of the hospital yesterday, and she's doing fine, and they both wish everyone their best, and Happy New Year. While I was at breakfast, someone said, "Are you nervous?" And I want to let you know I'm not a bit nervous, because I've got a pretty good idea what I'm going to say, and you haven't any idea what you're going to hear. So if anyone should be nervous, it should be you and not me. I also want to recognize the Al-Anons and welcome all the Al-Anons and non-alcoholics that are here this morning. Kind of reminds me of a story. I got sober in Texas, and there was a story that went around back then about Lance and Chris. And Lance was a real big guy, and Chris was a real petite woman, and he had been trying to get sober, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, without a whole lot of luck. And she had started going to Al-Anon. They started teaching Chris about tough love. And one day, Lance came home on a Saturday afternoon drunk, and they started fighting. And that continued for about 2 hours, and Lance was losing that battle. And he decided he'd go in the bathroom, and he shut the door, and about 20 minutes later, Chris came and knocked on the door and said, "Lance, what are you doing in there?" And he says, "I'm committing suicide. I've got the bath drawn and the gas on." And she said, "Would you please put some towels around the bottom of the door? It's making the cat sick." I guess that's tough love. I got sober in Texas, and down in Texas, we always give our sobriety date. And at one meeting, there was a guy, he said, and they do it different ways. Some people say, "I'm Dick, and I haven't found it necessary to drink for this period of time, and I'm Tom, and I had my last drink at this date." And this one guy says, "My name is Ed, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 14 years, 6 months, 3 days, and 9 hours. And someone in the back of the room says, "I saw you drunk Saturday night." And he said, "Yeah, but it wasn't necessary." I do think every drink I had was necessary to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for that. I grew up in a home where my dad was a member of AA. So when I grew up, I don't really remember his drinking. He got sober when I was very young. I remember a little bit of it and some fighting and things like that. But my dad got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and my mother in Al-Anon. And, you know, so I grew up seeing AA work in my house. You know, there were always people at our home. They were going to meetings or doing a 12-step call or having a meal or doing the things that we do around the family. And I got to experience that growing up. It wasn't really uncommon, you know, to wake up in the morning and go down to get ready for school and have someone shaking, you know, sitting at the table. Or coming home from school and having people having dinner with us before the evening meeting that night. So I knew that AA was there, and I knew that it was good, and I knew that it worked. I saw families being restored, people coming back to health. I saw all of the goodness that Alcoholics Anonymous offered. And I thought it was a great program for those of you that needed it. But I wasn't sure I wanted any part of it. And, you know, I don't remember, you know, my first drunk. I remember the first time I drank, And it was at my older brother's first communion. So it was about, I was about second grade. And it wasn't like when I drank it, it hit the bottom and went boom, and I danced with all the girls and all of that. But what happened to me was I remember stealing the beer, drinking it, and going back and taking more and hiding it so that I could have it the next day. And that was, you know, what I remember of drinking initially was I wanted more. I wanted to be able to do it again. There was some thrill about this consuming alcohol and drinking and partying that just seemed right for me. And then later I did realize that as I drank, I changed and I felt good. I felt like I fit in. You know, all of the speakers that spoke this weekend all said some things that I can identify with. Some things that are very similar about my story, and I'm going to let you figure out what they are, okay? Instead of me trying to tell you what's similar about our stories. Some of them are not similar at all, and I'm not going to talk about my ass. But I've got no jokes there. But you know, it's amazing that we come to these meetings and we do hear bits and pieces of our story, because if we're alcoholic, one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, we have that identity. We know what that feeling is. We know what those feelings were. We know why, you know, we go out and do the things that we did. And I don't think if we're non-alcoholic, even though non-alcoholics still feel feelings and pain and remorse and anger and jealousy and fear, just like the alcoholic. I just think sometimes the alcoholic has a magnifying glass, and some of those things are intensified. Certainly the things that we do to ourselves, it's destructive on a regular basis, just don't make sense to people that don't have the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, my first detox, and that's my alcohol story, my drinking story. I'm not going to go into a lot of morbid detail about the things that I did and where I did them and all of that, but I will tell you my first detox was in Children's Hospital. And that was in Buffalo, New York. I was 15 years old. And they put me there because they didn't have anywhere else to put me. And it was for alcohol and other pharmaceutical aids. Okay? Because we're at AA, I don't like to talk about those things. But I want you to know there's an awful lot of groups out there today. As a matter of fact, I talked to the archivist in New York, and since 1951, there have been 343 different organizations granted permission to use the 12 steps and 12 traditions. I probably qualify for 342. So there's OA and NA and PA and CA and GA and SA, and they've got a new one, it's Paranoia Anonymous. They've got an unlisted number, and they don't tell anybody where they meet. But you know, while I was in that hospital, I made an agreement that I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous when I got out. And I also said that I would go to counseling. Those were the two conditions that they let me out of there. And when they did, I really wanted to please my family and the people who were trying to help me. That was important to me because I felt like I was a tremendous disappointment to them for the condition that I had gotten myself into by that point in my life. And I went to counseling, and 6 weeks later I was smoking pot with a counselor. It was a new therapy they were trying. And I remember going to my first AA meeting. I went with my dad and his sponsor. And it was in Orchard Park, New York. And my dad's sponsor got sober December of 1946. And we went to that meeting that night. And it was just like all the meetings I've been to since. Went around, and this one said, I'm Ed, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm Art, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm Dorothy, and I'm an alcoholic. And it came to me, and I said, I'm Mike, and I'm a problem drinker with alcoholic tendencies. Because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. You know, before I go any further, I do want to welcome all the new people. I want to let you know that anything that I say here this morning is my opinion of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and my opinion of my own interpretation of my story as I remember it. Because I have talked to family members who remember my story a little differently than me. Okay? But this is where I'm at today, and this is how I remember it. And no one has the right to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. We don't have authorities in AA. So I didn't write the book, and I don't want to come across like I did. But I will tell you that I'm grateful to all of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous for putting up with me. I came to those meetings starting in 1975. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and the nice people in AA would say things like, if you keep doing the things you're doing, this is what's going to happen to you. And they would tell me some stories about things that had happened to them. And over the next 10 years, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis, and I never got sober. And I kept coming back, because they said, keep coming back. And I didn't really have any place else to go. When things got bad enough, I came to AA. But you know, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you're not ready, you hear things differently. And what I was hearing, and I know that that's not what we're talking about at AA, but what I think I was hearing at that time was, don't drink and go to a meeting. And I'm telling you, I wouldn't drink. I'd come to a meeting, and then I'd want to die because I was miserable. And I couldn't handle all of my feelings. And I'd see you guys, and you know, you'd be smiling and hugging each other and getting medallions and eating cake and all of this stuff, and I would get a resentment. Because I'd think you were different than me. You had to be different than me because you were getting well, and God knows I wanted to. But I wouldn't drink. You know, I'd come to these meetings. And that went on for 10 years. And during that 10-year period, I got to visit a lot of the places that the people in AA told me that I would visit. Got to be in a psychiatric ward and many hospitals. And, you know, people would bail me out of jams. And that was my thing. Just help me out this last time. And it's going to be better. I'm going to manage and control this better next time. If you just help me get a job, give me a couple of dollars, you know. If you'll just forgive me, I really didn't mean to do it anyway. Or, well, I was drunk. Yeah, like Dick said yesterday, you know, I was drunk. Well, of course I was drunk. That's pretty much all I knew how to do. You know, and I drank for the effect produced by alcohol, period. That was why I drank. And that's why I used every other chemical that I ever used. It was simply for the effect produced by those chemicals so I could get out of me and feel comfortable. And the quicker I could get to that place, the better. And that's all I cared about. Well, I'd come into these meetings as sincere as possible. And I'd sit there and I would try to get through a day without drinking. And it just, 2 or 3 days later, I'd be back out there. Or they'd put me in a hospital, I'd get healthy, and then I would come to AA, and then I'd be back out there. And I'd scratch my head, and I would think, why am I doing this? Why does this keep happening to me? When things are going good, I would do something to ruin them. I mean, I would be, you know, I had this great job. I was working on a golf course. It was a fantastic job. And I got paid one night and stopped at the bar and ended up in New York City. You know, I lived in Buffalo. And things, behaviors like that. So I lost the job, lost everything, and that's what happened. Well, by April of 1985, I got myself to a condition of hopelessness, or seemingly hopelessness, as our book talks about. And I didn't know what to do, so I had this great idea that it was time for me to commit suicide. Because if I did that, I couldn't drink anymore, and I couldn't not drink. And I tried all these other programs, and they didn't seem to work. So suicide seemed like a good option. I broke into a house in Buffalo, a couple of people that I knew, and I knew that he had a gun. So I started going through all the rooms of the house trying to find his gun. And I never found it. Later I learned that they were target shooting. I think God had a plan. And I got on the third story of that house that morning. And I looked out the window, and I was trying to calculate if I dove out the window head first, if I would die. Because I had already had so much pain, I didn't want any more pain. And I'm thinking, am I going to flop around on this sidewalk for an hour until someone finds me, or will I really die? And while I'm looking out that window, I see a couple ladies walking down the street wearing hats. Now, this was probably a hallucination. But I see these women coming down the street wearing hats, and it reminded me of my grandmother when I was a youngster, would come over after church on Sunday, and she would always bring some friends with her, and they were always wearing these funny church hats. So I saw her, I thought of church, and incidentally, it was interesting, But sometime before that, when I saw my grandmother for the last time, she said, her last words to me were, please stop drinking. So here these ladies come down the street that morning, and I thought of church. I got down on my knees in that room, and I said the alcoholic prayer, you know, God help me. And it was the room didn't light up, the wind didn't blow, and I did not feel like I was changed. But there were some things that began to happen in the invisible that I wasn't aware of. And I believe that, you know, my sponsor, Howard, today talks about our lives unfolding in divine order. And I really believe that that had begun to happen to me that morning. And I went through the rest of that day, and that night I picked up the phone. And I called the only person left that I thought might be willing to help me, and that was my dad. And that was because he was related to me, and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The next day, he and another guy sat down with me in a diner, and they did what we call a 12-step call. They talked to me about my options, and I didn't have any. I had no options left. And I said, I need help. I've got to get in somewhere. And they started making phone calls, and none of the hospitals wanted me because I'd been there too many times. And I called in every IOU that I had the next 3 days, and I could not get myself into a healthcare facility. And I ended up detoxing in this guy's basement. And I had some hallucinations there, too. Make a long story short, I agreed to sign myself into a facility for a year. And this was a place where they were sending people that were being released early from prison before they got back into the community. And the condition they were allowing me to enter this facility was that I agreed to stay for a year. Well, I was sick. I needed to get out of where I was at. It didn't matter to me what I was signing. I just needed to stop trying to live the way I was living. I couldn't do it anymore. So they sent me to this place. It was like a boot camp. And, you know, I was expecting treatment. And, you know, the night I got there, they gave me a bowl of noodles and some bread, and I thought, you know, I need a dietitian, you know. Still had ego. Well, about a week later, I called my dad when I had been granted permission to use the telephone. I think it took me a week before they allowed me to do that. And I called and I said, you got to get me out of here. And of course, my mother, the good Al-Anon's, thinking I'm up to my old tricks, you know. And my dad is worrying now. And he starts to do some investigating on this place, and he finds out that it's probably not the best place for me. So he calls down there and he tells them to stick me on a bus and send me back. And after he did that, he wasn't sure what he was going to do with me. And they had some fear of bringing me back into that community and back into their home. So he remembered a guy that he knew down in Brownwood, Texas, a guy named Big John. And he called John and he said, I got Mike here and he's in pretty bad shape. And John said, give him an airline ticket and send him down here to see me for a couple of weeks. So on May 5th, 1985, they stuck me on an airplane and sent me to Brownwood, Texas. And I got greeted at the airport in Abilene, Texas by Big John and two other guys from AA. And John got sober in October of 51, so he in 85 was considered a long timer. And he picked me up at the airport and he brought me to a meeting that night. And on the way to the meeting, he said, kid, we give our sobriety date here in Texas. If you got one and they call on you, just give it and then maybe you want to be quiet. And I was happy to do that. It came to me, and I wasn't sure what my sobriety date was, so I made one up. And, you know, the meeting was just like all the other meetings, but the people of Texas were very kind to me. And John brought me back to his apartment that night, and he was a big man. Some of you know him. He had spoke up here a few times. And he's a big guy, and he looks at me, and he's kind of pacing around the house, and he said, how long you been around the deal, kid? And with as much ego as you can have, when you weigh 90 pounds and you're wearing somebody else's pants? I said, oh, about 10 years. He says, well, kid, I don't know if you've got the guts it takes to make it, but if you do, we can show you by living proof how you never have to live that way again. And if you want to get sober, I'll go to hell and back with you. And if you don't, you can go to hell alone. And I'm thinking, welcome to Texas. A little while later, we're sitting there and John looks at me and he says, you are nothing but a thief. Then he went on and he said, maybe not the kind of thief that'd kick in a joint or steal money from your mother's purse. You're a worse kind of thief than that. Because you and me and every alcoholic are the thieves of the worst kind. Because we steal from those that we love the most their right to happiness. He said, you stole from those that you love the most their right to happiness. And I sat there that evening and realized, for the first time in 10 years, I was faced with the truth about myself, that I had become nothing more than a thief. And I said to everybody, leave me alone. You're the one that's got the problem. Just help me out here. I'm going to get over this thing. And I didn't realize for all those years what I was doing to everybody that was in my life. And I never wanted people to be disappointed. I wanted everybody to be proud of me. I wanted them to think I was a good guy because I knew inside I was. I just couldn't do it. You know, I was we had 7 kids in my family and I was the second one to graduate from high school. Okay? And I remember that day. That was a big day in my life. I'm going to graduate from high school. Now, I did not deserve to graduate from high school. They just kept passing me, even though I wasn't there. And that particular day, I remember on the way to graduation, I stopped at the bar because, see, in New York, you could drink when you were 18, and I had older brothers, so I could drink in the bars when I was 16. Well, on the way to the graduation, I stopped, and I had a couple of drinks. And when it was time to walk across the stage, they called my name. And I got out in the audience, my mom and my dad, my grandmother, and a couple other relatives, and I'm sure that they were proud. And they called Mike Fitzpatrick, and I start walking across the stage. And one of the guys out in the audience yells out as loud as he can, drugs, because that had become one of my nicknames in high school. And before I received my diploma, I stood there thinking, my parents can't be proud of me, you know? I felt like every occasion I had to bring joy into someone else's life, I ruined it. Something like that would happen. And here John says to me, you are a thief of the worst kind because you stole from those you love the most their right to happiness. So I thought it was about my right to happiness. I was doing things I thought was making me happy. You know, this is okay because I feel better when I do this. Well, that had long since left me. No longer did alcohol bring ease and comfort to my life. It brought misery, and I knew it. I just couldn't change it. I didn't have the power. Well, we visited that night as we did many nights, and the next day, Big John brought me to his friend Bill O's house, his best friend, and Bill lived in Brownwood. Every now and then, I'm going to look at my watch. I can't see it. Just to give you a sense of optimism. Howard would be mad at me for sharing that because he does it all the time. The next day, John brought me over to his friend Bill O. We pulled into the driveway at the Midwest Tape Library, and the Midwest Tape Library was the largest AA tape library in the world. We pulled into the driveway, and John says, Mike, this is the largest tape library, AA tape library in the world. And I said, so what? We walked in that house and he introduced me to Bill and Arbutus. And Bill, for those of you that didn't know Bill, he had one eye and one arm. And I immediately nicknamed him Grumpy in my mind. I never had the guts to say it to him. We walked in there and we sat down and started talking, and John and Bill And Bill got sober October 21st, 1951. And John got sober October 28th of 1951. So Bill had 1 week more than John. And he never let him forget it. Well, these guys start talking about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. They start talking about their friend, Bill W. and Abby. They told me about Sam Shoemaker and the Calvary Mission and the Oxford Group. And they talked to me about Dr. Bob and the work that had gone on in Akron and Cleveland when AA started. And they started sharing these things with me. And I was listening. Now, I got to tell you, when I came to you folks of Alcoholics Anonymous, my vocabulary was limited. I think I could get about a 7-word sentence out, and 3 of them started with F. And I must have said one of my sentences that morning. And Bill took his finger and he started pounding it down on the table, and he said, "Young man, the first thing we clean up in here is our mouth." I thought he was kind of grumpy. On the way home that day, I said to John, "What's up with him? I'm 25 years old. You guys are going to start to tell me how I have to talk?" And he said, "Well, kid, this program saved our lives. And we have a lot of respect for this program. You know, we knew Bill W., and we knew a lot of these early members. We've been sober a little bit of time here. And you may be the only big book that some new guy or gal ever sees. And we want you to be a good example. And we want you to be accurate. And when we come into this deal, we need to change. And that's just part of the process. And I'm grateful that I bought into it at that time. And please understand, I'm not telling you that you shouldn't use bad language at a meeting. Okay? I'm sharing my opinion. And if that works for you, I'm grateful. You know, I've been going to the meetings there in Texas, and I was starting to feel a little bit better. John traveled a lot. He got back from one of his trips, and I said, "I did it." And he said, "What?" And I said, "I read the big book." And I was like a proud kid. And he said, "I read Moby Dick, and I don't remember a damn bit of it, kid." He said, "We got to study that book." And the next day, we took out our big books and we started to study. We had highlighters in our hands. And we'd get to a point in the book where I didn't understand something. And I'd ask a question. And he'd try his best to answer it after he told me to get out of the debating society. Because I debated everything. But I read in the doctor's opinion where it talked about a psychic change. And I thought, man, that's cool. I want one of them. I want a psychic change. Then it said the only thing necessary to have this psychic change was that to be willing to follow a few simple rules. And I thought, okay, I got to do something. See, because alcohol beat me into a condition of willingness, and I was beginning to get willing to do the things that were necessary for me to get up, stand up, and stay up. And I'd get down on my knees every morning, and I'd say, "God, help me get through this day without thinking about taking a drink." Because I still wanted to drink in my mind. See, my mind was so obsessed with the alcohol that I still wanted to drink. And I said, "God, help me get through this day without thinking about taking a drink." And I'd go through the day and I'd do the things they were sharing with me to do. And I'd get through the day and I wouldn't take a drink. And one day began to be 2 days and 3 and 6 and 9 and so on. And the time began to add up. And one day it was like magic. I was getting ready for bed, and it dawned on me. I'd gone through the entire day, and I never thought about taking a drink. The thought never had entered my mind. And I'd love to tell you today, from that day to this, it's never entered my mind. It has on an occasion, but very rare. And when it does, I know exactly what to do. I know exactly how to deal with that. And I started reading that big book. You know, I thought drinking was my problem. Started reading it. You know, they said I'm the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. Yeah, I think every AA meeting is a spiritual meeting. And I think every person who talks at an AA meeting is given a spiritual talk. So I don't want to put myself in a classification of having that pressure put on me. But if God sees fit to talk through me today to someone, I'm grateful for that. Came to a page in that big book that said, lack of power is our dilemma. I thought drinking was the problem. The book tells me lack of power is our dilemma. Then a little while after that, it said that the main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. The steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous introduced me to a power greater than myself that I prefer to call God today, that has helped me to have the strength and the ability one day at a time to abstain from alcohol and live a pretty decent life with reasonable contentment and reasonable peace of mind with your help. That was the thing about AA, is I didn't have to do it by myself. See, I got drunk and we get sober. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, is we get sober together. We don't have to be by ourselves anymore. I used to be able to be in a room like this and I'd be all alone. And today I don't have to be lonely anymore because I have a relationship with a power greater than myself. I've got my friends and family. I've got Alcoholics Anonymous, people that I sponsor. Yeah, I love sponsoring people. And if you don't have that opportunity yet, you know, stand at the door and greet people when they get here. They used to do that for me. They used to say, kid, I want you to stand at the door today. When people get here, I want you to tell them that you're glad that you see them. And quite honestly, I didn't care. But I was willing to do what they were saying. So I'd stand at the door and I'd say, hi, I'm Mike, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad you're here. I don't know if I meant it or not, but I was following the directions that were being shared with me. After a while, I bumped into a guy there in Brownwood. He had been a regular at the meetings, but this particular night, I looked at him, and he kind of glowed, and he had this big smile, and he always seemed happy. His name was AJ, and I said, AJ, how you doing? He says, I'm doing wonderful. And I said, do you really mean that? And he said, yeah. And he said, and it keeps getting better. And I thought, when I left that meeting, wow, you know, I want to kind of have that attitude. You know, I want to adopt that attitude of life is good today and it's getting better. Because when I came here, I would have cheered up this whole room by leaving. Okay? See, I was one of these guys that somebody licked all the red off their candy. Okay? I complained a lot. I had a lot of anger. Okay? A lot of resentment. A lot of fear, and the way my fear would manifest itself was I would lash out because that's what I knew to do. If I could make you feel less than, I felt okay. And that's how I came to you. And you folks loved me when I wasn't lovable. You know, they did. I get a little irritated at times when I go to meetings and I hear people say things like, take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth. You don't know nothing. When I came here, blah, blah, blah. Let me tell you about when I came here. This is how I came to you. I was broken. I was beaten. I was done. And the guys in AA said, I remember John, hey, kid, will you cook me breakfast? Could you make those eggs with a little yolk on them? I'd cook them a couple of eggs, probably taste like crap. He'd go around the rest of the day bragging about me. He'd say, man, this kid is a cook. He made me breakfast this morning, best breakfast I ever had. One time he asked me to make him spaghetti and meatballs. Can you try to get those meatballs so they'll stay together? You know, I probably put 4 eggs in, you know, a pound of burger or something, but I got 2 weeks worth of compliments out of that. Oh, this kid learned how to cook from his mother, you know. He's the best cook. He made me spaghetti and meatballs. Well, what started happening was I started to feel good about myself. They started to find things in me that they could lift me up and make me feel like I belonged. And I am so grateful for that. They never knocked me down. Never one time in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous has anybody ever embarrassed me. And I get embarrassed when I see people do it. That's not AA. AA is lifting these people up. Alcoholism kicked our butt. And we get here, we need someone to say, we love you and we're glad you're here. I get a little passionate. All right, Sunday morning, if I start going up back and forth and doing a Jimmy Swaggart, I'll stop. But I am passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am passionate about the newcomers, and I do believe that we have to be an example of what this program is. I went to a lot of meetings with John in the beginning. He introduced me to a lot of people. Had the opportunity to meet Smitty, Dr. Bob's son, Bob Jr. And I remember one day Bob said to me, Mike, did Bill and John ever talk to you about the first guy that my dad and Bill Wilson worked with? And I immediately, you know, because now I'm learning the history, I immediately said, oh yeah, Bill D., Akron City Hospital, AA number 3. And he said, well, no, Mike, actually there was a guy before Bill D. This guy's name was Eddie. And he said they moved Eddie and Eddie's family into their house there on Ardmore Avenue in Akron, Ohio. And Eddie and his family lived upstairs, and Eddie was a bad drunk. And Eddie would open the window late at night, and he'd climb out, and he'd escape, and he'd go get drunk. And Bill and Dr. Bob would go round Eddie up and bring him back and try to carry the message to him as they were getting it. One particular day, Eddie was chasing Dr. Bob's wife, Ann, around the house with a butcher knife. That was the first guy that Bill and Bob tried to work with. And he had to be committed. So the first guy, as far as Bill and Bob experience, was seemingly a complete failure. Smitty said, Mike, this story doesn't stop there. 15 years later, at Dr. Bob's funeral, a guy approached Smitty, and he said, you know who I am? And he looked at him, and he said, yeah, you're Eddie. And he said, I've been sober for 2.5 years. And when I told you that night I prayed, there were things happening in the invisible. I think that was one of them. Because I found out that morning, when Smitty shared that story, that I was exactly where I belonged, because for that 10 years that I came to you folks and back out and in and out and in, I thought I was a failure and you were successful. And when he told me the story of the very first guy, I realized that Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't built on success. It was built on failure. And it came as a result of that, and I was home for the first time and knew I belonged here. And I'm grateful for the history. And the history has become something very near and dear to me. You know, that library I told you about, I've got that in my home today. 3,000 reel-to-reel tapes. And we're working to try to get those digitized so that we can make them available to the next generation of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Because the history is important. There's a lot of neat things there. You know, Bill used to travel all over, and he'd drive to these conferences, and, you know, talk about being lifted up. One day John said, Bill's going to be taping up in Casper, Wyoming, kid. And I said, great. And he said, he'd like you to go with him. He wants you to drive. I said, oh, that'll be fun. He said, well, I got to tell you, Bill has never let anybody drive for him. I'm really, he says, you're the first guy he's ever let drive. And he wants you to come along to help him drive. Wasn't until about 5 years ago his daughter said, oh, he had people drive all the time. I'm like, no, don't say that. Come on. It's going to ruin my story. He let me drive some. And that's not real memorable to me, but what was memorable was when he was driving through Denver, okay? It was just snowing so hard. Now remember, he's got one arm, one eye, okay? He smokes a pipe. He's driving. Snowing real hard. He didn't believe in speed limit. He figured if the car went that fast, it was okay. He's lighting his pipe. It's snowing. He's doing 80. Driving with his knee. I'm having a new experience with my higher power. What was really sick about the whole thing was he was watching my reaction the whole time with his one eye. You know, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to laugh. They showed me that I could have fun. They brought a spirit of life to me that I didn't have before, and I'm grateful to be able to tell stories like that, because those are the experiences I had, the things that had happened to me. You know, it wasn't all painful in the beginning. I hear people come in, oh man, the first year is tough. Let me tell you something. My first year, yeah, it was tough. I didn't have a job. I was living with an 80-year-old guy. I was going to meetings every day. I was away from my family. I had all kinds of time and didn't know what I'd ever do with it. I used to say to John, what am I going to do with all my time? I'm just going crazy. He'd say, walk the dog, kid. And I'd take the dog for a walk. And a little while later, I'd say, what am I going to do? And he'd say, why don't you take the dog for another walk, kid? And I would. Today, I don't have time to take the dog for a walk. See, because we get busy in life. And in the beginning, I thought I couldn't see that there was going to be a life in front of me. I didn't know what was to come. I had to trust. I had to have some faith. I had to look at these guys that had walked the walk and did this thing before me that could show me and guide me and teach me and give me that encouragement that I so badly needed. That's what you did. That's what they did. And then I got into the steps of the program and studying the big book and got to meet these people, and my life began to get a little bit better. John would take me around and he'd say, you know, and it was like when I got 6 months, you know, you thought they were going to have a parade, you know. The kid got 6 months and everybody's clapping. When I got a year, you know, that was a miracle for me. You know, that was unbelievable for me to have a year of sobriety. My life had already changed. I had begun to have this psychic change that the book talked about. I began to see, and you know, when I read that book, I saw where it said that, and I don't quote a lot of the book, but it says something like, it's a great obsession of every abnormal drinker to somehow, some way, control and enjoy his drinking. That the persistence of this illusion is astonishing, and many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. And when I got off that airplane weighing 90 pounds wearing somebody else's pants, and I review through my mind's eye the 10 years that I had been out there doing my thing, and then I saw this, and I realized once again, I'm not alone. I'm not the only one that felt that way. I'm not the only one who tried to make this thing work. If there was any opportunity left in my life when I came to you folks, if there was another person that I could have taken from, okay? If there's another person I could have taken from mentally, physically, financially, I would have done so. There was no one left. I was done, completely done. For me, I'm grateful because it wasn't until that time that I would allow this loving God into my life. It wasn't until all human resources were gone that I would consider accepting God in my life. And I say God, and you can say higher power or whatever works for you. I'm comfortable with that. Please, you know, have an open mind. That's what they said to me when I came here. Have an open mind. Be willing. Okay? Try to get honest with yourself. And I tried to do that. But I knew once I got into the program, began to work these steps and try to bring the principles into my life so that I could live these principles, my life started to get a little bit better. And as my life started to get a little bit better, things started to change. And one night I said to Big John, I don't feel like going to the meeting tonight. And he said, why not, kid? And I was getting honest. And I said, well, you know, the meeting was in Bangs, Texas. Now, Bangs was kind of a small town. There was about 200 people and about 300 sheep. I used to say nervous sheep, but I took that out. And I said this particular evening, you know, John, it's the same people and the same thing. And besides, there's a baseball game on tonight, and I'd kind of like to see it. And he said, kid, we don't go to the meetings to get. We go to the meetings to give. And I said, maybe you, Mr. AA, what do I have to give? I've got nothing. And he said, I'm just trying to see if I'm supposed to be done. He said, there may be somebody there tonight for their first meeting. And your example that you're sober today might be all it takes for them to say, I can stay sober today too. And from that day to this, I've never gone to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to get. I've gone to give. And in giving, I've received so much more. You know, I was about a little over 2 years sober. You know, if you remember back early in the story, I said, John said, fly him down here for a couple of weeks. I stayed a couple of years. And I decided I would move to Arizona because I lived there for a short time as a kid. And I loved the sunshine. And I knew I couldn't go back to Buffalo. Not just because of the clouds and the snow and the cold weather, but because that was not the right place for me. And I knew that. So I made my way to Phoenix, Arizona, and I was living with a guy in AA. And all I could talk about at the time was AA. It's all I knew, you know. I was a walking, jabbering AA meeting. When I wasn't in an AA meeting, I was listening to an AA tape. Okay? I mean, that was just where I was sponsoring people, where I was reading a book to them or doing whatever I could do, but it was all AA. And this one particular day, I'm out by the pool, and this girl gets in and dives in the water, and I took a look, and I dove in after her. And I went up, and I said, we started talking, introduced myself. I'm sure I was talking about AA. She was a school teacher from Michigan, and she was very polite and nice, and I asked her out on a date, and she had other plans, and you know, I was discouraged. You know, I mean, I'm going to give you a little more about my story. All my dating before I came to AA was pathetic. Okay? See, I didn't have to give you a fifth step, did I? One word, we all understand. It was pathetic. Okay? Well, here I'm asking this girl on a date. She's got other plans. I feel rejected. You know, I take it personal. Well, what do? I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I worked with the guys on sponsoring, because that's what the big book tells me to do. Later on in that week, we see each other again, and she said, my plans have changed. And my dad has tickets to a baseball game. Would you like to come? And I said, certainly, as long as we could go to dinner first. And she said, yes. So I picked her up. It's August. Phoenix, Arizona. I'm driving a black Ford Fairmont with no air conditioning. We're going to go to a baseball game and sit outside. What a date. The restaurant, and Joy could tell this better than me, but she got her fortune cookie, and I share what I think it said, and I know that it's something close. But what I remember it saying was something like, you can trust the man you're with. His love is true. 4 months later, we were married. We celebrated 20 years here at this conference. Okay. Had they asked me what I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I would have been honest, I would have said I wanted a girlfriend. I wanted a place to live. And I wanted a car. And I would have taken a girlfriend that had both. That was about as much as my mind could go to. That was about, you see, long before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I stopped dreaming. See, the dreams had left. There was nothing left to dream about. I didn't dream about a wife and a family and a job and a home and things like that. I didn't dream about those things. I dreamt about, how is I going to get out of this one? Wonder if they're going to catch up to me this time. The behavior that I had, John said to me, kid, do you feel rejected? And I said, of course I do. He said, well, you weren't rejected. What was rejected was your behavior. And if you change your behavior, you'll no longer be rejected. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to change my behavior, so I'm no longer rejected. He told me a story that Bill Dobson, AA number 3, shared. And he looked at him and he said, what's this deal AA about? And Bill answered back, AA, John, your life and mine are made up of 4 things: thoughts, actions, habits, and character. You want to go live in the life of a drunk? You go ahead and think like a drunk. You'll act like a drunk. You'll have the habits of a drunk. You're going to have the life of a drunk. But in this fellowship of the second chance, we can show you how you can begin to think like a useful and a decent person. And from that, you'll have the actions of a useful and a decent person. And you will then develop the habits of a useful and a decent person. And once more, you can be restored to the life of a useful and a decent person. That's what AA's done. You know, a couple of years ago, my wife's mother came to our house and she said, would you consider having Grandma move in with you? And we talked about it and prayed about it, and we agreed that that was the right thing to do. She was 97 years old and she was moving to our house from the nursing center. She was a total care patient. My wife was working as a school teacher at the time, and it was going to be my responsibility to take care of her, to do everything, to feed her, to lift her into bed, to do it. Okay? And the first night they brought her there, I knew I couldn't do this. And I went in my room just like I do when I'm sponsoring a new guy. And I got down on my knees and I said, God, I can't do this. I need you to do this. And from that day until the day that she passed away, I never had to think about it again. Because I was able to do something I couldn't do. Because, you see, I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know how to do this stuff. I don't have the power to do it. But I've got a God of my understanding in my life today that you've given to me that has the power to do these things. And I think that that's what John was talking about when he said that we can be restored to a life of usefulness and decency. That we can do for others what we couldn't do before. And God will do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And that God won't do for me what I can do for myself. And that means I had to have some action. They talked to me about the promises of the program, and it said, if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. It doesn't say, well, if you just go to a meeting and don't drink. There's something involved here. And maybe that painstaking implies a little bit of effort. And I needed to put some effort into this thing to get something out of it. And what I've gotten out of it is so much more than I ever thought. Today I have my wife and we have 3 children. We've got a beautiful home. We've got a great lifestyle. I've got a house full of happiness and love and joy and peace and serenity. And we get to do these things. We get to sponsor people. There's people, I've got one guy, train wreck, okay? By the time I get some of the guys to sponsor, they've been in an AA a whole in and out, in and out, in and out, you know? And then they hear my story and then they come, you know? And it's okay. It's okay to me that if you've been in this deal for trying to get it for 10 years, today can be the day that you stand at the turning point and you never ever have to go back out there because we have a program that has a solution. I think, is it time for me to quit? I mean, really, I don't know. No, about 3 more minutes? You know, Dr. Bob in his last talk said that, and Dr. Bob's last talk was in Cleveland. You know, Dr. Bob was only with us for 15 years, okay? His last talk was in Cleveland at the first international convention when the traditions had become part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for the traditions. You know, the first tradition is our common welfare comes first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And the only way we can stay unified in AA is if our common welfare comes first. That is critical. So everybody that comes into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is just as important as anybody else. We don't have seniority in AA where you get to a certain point. Now you come in and you do this and then you'll be like him and you'll be a real member. We don't have that. If you come in here today and you have a desire not to drink, you're just as much a member as Lenny with 35 years. Now you may not have that experience. May not have the same experience. But you have the same opportunity. I'm grateful to those guys that stood there and extended the hand of kindness and consideration to me, that lifted me up, and I hope that I can do that for someone else. And I'll tell you, I do believe the newcomers are the lifeblood or the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the old-timers are the backbone. And don't go pick up a newcomer without stopping and picking up one of the longtime older members of AA and bring them to the meeting with you. That's what we need to be doing. That's how we have unity in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's about taking care of each other. All right, I'll stop preaching. I'm real passionate about that. I'll tell you, because when I got sober, it was like AA school on wheels. See, we'd be driving along, I'd be driving John to an AA conference. And he'd say, "What's Dr. Bob's address, kid?" See, all of a sudden, those kind of things took an importance in my life. See, it became important for me to know the history of AA. I spent a lot of time with that today. And I'm grateful I get to do some writing and help other people learn about the history and about the traditions. And it's really done something for my sobriety. It's really helped to complete my sobriety, if you will, in the form of I no longer have that space that needs to be filled. I know now what I'm supposed to do. And Tom I, a very dear friend of mine, he was speaking back a few years ago, and he said that the way we come into Alcoholics Anonymous is often what we're most passionate about. And, you know, Tom came in through the prison system, and he stayed very committed to H&I and to that work, and I'm grateful that he did. And when he said that, I realized why my house looks like a museum. See? It was because of how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, Dr. Bob in his last talk said that if you simmered Alcoholics Anonymous down to just two things, you'd have love and you'd have service. And love being an unbiased attitude of goodwill toward everyone. See? And I said to John, "What does that mean?" And he says, "Oh, kid, that just means you don't wish someone get hit by a car." And I thought, I could do that. See, they lowered the bar. They lowered the bar so that I could do it. See? I didn't have to get up to where you were. They came down to where I was. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you study the history of AA, you'll learn about a guy named Roland Hazard. Roland's one of the guys that went to Evie. Okay? Roland's a guy that was cared for by Dr. Carl Jung. Okay? And Jung said, "Roland, you're done. I can't help you." And Roland said, "Oh, doctor, there's got to be a way." And he said, "The only way I know is through a spiritual conversion, and I've been trying to do these things for you and haven't been able to." And Roland left Switzerland a failure, a broken man, hopeless. And he picked up a book called Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. And in that book, he read about a conversion of a drunkard named Samuel Hadley, who walked into the Water Street Mission in 1878 in New York. And while he was there, he had a conversion and he quit drinking and he spent the rest of his life working at that mission, helping other people to stop drinking. His name was Samuel Hadley. Roland read his story and had a conversion. He went to Calvary Mission in 1931 in New York City to the Oxford Group. And who does he meet when he walks in there? Samuel Hadley's son, Henry Hadley. He was the caretaker of the mission for Sam Shoemaker. Don't tell me God doesn't work in our lives. He was lining this whole thing up so we could sit here and have this meeting today. And Dr. Bob had great wisdom when he said that. My sponsor's sponsor was a guy named Dick, and Dick closed a talk one day and he said, a bell is not a bell until we ring it. And a song is not a song until we sing it. And love wasn't put in our hearts to stay. Love is only love when we give it away. Alcoholics Anonymous is only Alcoholics Anonymous to me if I'm willing to be here and give it away. See, that's how this deal works. Bill goes to Akron. He knew that he couldn't drink anymore. He had spent 6 months in New York trying to sober up all the drunks. Nobody stayed sober, but he did. He got in Akron and he's pacing up and down the hallway of the Mayflower Hotel, and the thought of drinking comes to his mind because his business was gone and he was out of money. And he sees that church directory and he says, I'll call. I'll just call someone. And he calls a weird name, Tunks. And he says, I'm a drunk from New York and I've got a cure and I need to talk to someone. And he gives him some names and Bill ends up calling Henrietta and she puts him in touch with Dr. Bob. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous was born. And that's why we're here. Now, I really don't know. I've talked an hour, right? Because I could go till like 3. The flight leaves at 6:40. I hope your chairs are comfortable. But John warned me, I was kind of reminded of this last night at the table when someone was making sure I understood that my job was to be the spiritual speaker. John said, kid, just remember, it's only 6 inches from a halo to a noose. See, he knew that ego was a problem with alcoholics, and he knew that I needed ego deflation at depth. And he said, when you think you're important, you start taking for granted and you think that you're the most important person in this room, follow these simple instructions and see if it'll humble your soul. Take a pail, fill it with water. Put your hand in it up to the wrist. Pull it out. Look at the hole. That's just a measure of how much you'll be missed. I'm grateful that I've had people like that to share with me, to help me understand that I'm just another drunk that was given the grace to be sober today, to stand at the door, to greet the next new person that comes in, and to tell them, we're glad you're here. You helped me stay sober today, and hope that they stay long enough to understand that that's the truth. See, we don't say that just because it sounds good. We say it because it's the truth. See, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, we learn the truth about ourselves. See, we learn that of ourselves, we are nothing. Our strength must come from a power greater than us. If we don't have that, we'll never learn how to get up, stand up, and stay up. And when I was out there fighting this battle of alcoholism, and I was losing every time, I always thought that I was a bad guy who needed to get good. And you folks said, no, you're a sick guy that needs to get well. And we can show you how you can get well. And you loved me when I couldn't love myself. You loved me when I wasn't lovable. You taught me when I wasn't teachable. You hung in there and you put up with me, and I'm grateful for that. And I hope today I remember that with every guy that I get to sponsor. Every time they struggle and they call me and they're an inconvenience to me, I hope I realize that I may have been an inconvenience to someone else. Big John had a one-bedroom apartment. I got the bed. He took the couch. That's the kind of sponsorship I had coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. And I'd rather you walk with me than just tell the way, because the eye is quicker and it's more willing than the ear. And it's your example that makes it mighty clear. And the best of men are the preachers who live by their creed, because seeing good put into actions what every one of us needs. And that's the life that I try to live today. In my home with my children, and in the meetings that I go to, and in public, and wherever I am. I hope that I can remember that 11th tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. That this program is based on attraction rather than promotion. That my job is to be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope I'm a good one. I want to thank you again for having me, and God bless all of you.